Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with an East County Magazine special report. Our investigation is turning up some troubling answers to serious safety concerns raised by rural residents. Those residents want to know why a truck carrying a load 3 times longer than allowed on Highway 94 was authorized to travel along the narrow, winding road. The truck's load was so wide that it blocked traffic both ways, even when it was moving slowly along the route. Then it broke down, blocking traffic completely for over 50 hours. Even after the road was finally cleared, the big rig remained on the shoulder at Marin Valley Road in Dilsura, along Highway 94, for 2 weeks before it was finally removed. Authorities never informed the media, and no SIG alert was issued to alert residents before the oversized load took to the highway, obstructing the main evacuation route for residents in areas including Hamul, Deerhorn Valley, Potrero, Barrett Junction, and Tecate. During the blockage, residents were forced to detour up to 90 miles, causing delays of many hours. Eventually, a SIG alert was issued, but not until 7 hours after the road was completely blocked, after the truck broke down. The load was reportedly 231 feet long, yet posted signs indicate the maximum truck length allowed is just 75 feet. So why was this rig bound to Mexico allowed to take this narrow route with many hairpin curves instead of safer alternatives? When the truck was finally removed, signs were posted on Highway 94 near the turnoff for Route 188 to Tecate. The signs advise motorists to expect long delays, but again, media was not notified, and no SIG alert was issued to warn motorists of this delay. The signs were left up, moreover, the next day after the truck was moved overnight, causing confusion and even more inconvenience for residents. Deerhorn Valley Antler editor Kim Hamilton has reported that the truck had California Highway Patrol escorts at the start of its trip, according to several witnesses. The Antler also reports that the trucking company, KD Specialized, claimed that the California Highway Patrol planned the route. CHP Captain Tim Lupper, however, told East County Magazine reporter Nadine Abbott that Caltrans insisted on this route, which was ultimately approved by CHP's Industrial Escort Division in Claremont Mesa. Lupper said the truck broke an axle 3 times. He advised that the truck was ultimately bound for Ensenada. This raises many questions. Why did Caltrans request a route on winding mountain roads to a remote border crossing in Tecate instead of using the crossing at San Ysidro, where the truck would have been on Interstate 5, a major freeway, on the U.S. side of the border, or even the Otay crossing, which has far fewer curves along the way? And why did CHP approve this treacherous route, even if Caltrans did ask for it? The truck was reportedly carrying an air compressor used in mining operations that weighs 200,000 pounds, according to Marcia Spurgeon, a local real estate agent who looked into the trucking records. A request for records from the California Highway Patrol sent by East County Magazine on August 8th has still not yet been answered. On Thursday, we contacted State Senator Joel Anderson and Assemblyman Brian Jones for help to obtain answers and solutions to prevent a similar problem in the future. Assemblyman Jones' office contacted the CHP just hours after receiving our request. Captain Lepper from the CHP then left a message on our answering machine promising to look into the matter. He told our reporter that the CHP media spokesperson has been on vacation. Deerhorn Valley Antler editor Kim Hamilton has voiced serious concerns over the dangers posed to residents in this wildfire-prone rural area. In an email sent during the blockage, she said, "The situation stinks," adding, "Let's hope there's not a fire today that units can't get to. Very hot, very dry." She wants to know why SIG alerts were not called until 7 hours after the major access route for her community was closed. And at least one emergency did occur during the shutdown. It turns out there was a bad snake bite in Potrero that day, too, Hamilton informed East County Magazine, adding that the patient was life-flighted to a hospital. Now, whether that patient could have been transported by ambulance, had the road not been blocked, is unknown. But if life flight should be needed due to a road blockage or worse, if a patient should die due to lack of access in an emergency, then potentially the state could incur liability, leaving taxpayers to foot the bill for the damages. Robin Brailsford, an area resident, asks, what is the cost of 6 CHP escorts? She further notes that the truck damaged embankments on both sides of Highway 94, knocking large rocks and debris onto the shoulder. Who will pay those cleanup costs? After the breakdown at Marin Valley Road, Brailsford reported seeing numerous county trucks doing grading, as well as Border Patrol vehicles, all at an intersection on a blind corner where multiple fatalities have occurred on an F-rated highway. Many serious accidents, including numerous fatalities, have occurred on Highway 94. Residents have long worried about what would happen if a wildfire occurred when an accident is blocking their evacuation route on the main highway. The stuck truck fiasco has also revived controversy over a casino proposed by the Hamul Indians on Highway 94 in the Hamul area. Connie Wimple, in an email sent to East County Magazine, wrote, "This could be a disaster for all of us. This is just one more reason why a casino is a bad idea for this area." Residents are also disappointed that major media outlets in San Diego failed to cover this story. Most importantly, those who live in the rural areas and who rely on Highway 94 for their daily transportation needs and evacuation in case of emergencies want to know what will be done to prevent a similar threat to public safety from occurring again.
This is Allie McCall with KNSJ and East County Magazine, bringing you a weekend weather report. Before you make plans this weekend, be sure to check out our weather update. A tropical storm system has moved into our area, bringing thundershowers and dramatic lightning displays across East County's mountain areas, with flash flooding and severe dust storms reported in some desert areas on Thursday. Sunshine has returned on Friday, but the storm system is expected to weaken Saturday, with more thunderstorms and lightning forecast Sunday through Tuesday across our mountains and deserts.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
On Thursday evening, August 22nd, a monster-scale dust storm rolled across Ocotillo. The huge cloud of dust blackened the sky, covered homes, and obscured even wind turbines that are 500 feet tall. It looked like a scene out of the 1930s, when factory-scale farms removed topsoil in the Midwest, creating dust storms that swept across the western states, reducing vast areas to a giant dust bowl. Is history repeating itself? Residents of Ocotillo and other desert communities across the Southwest have recently been voicing worries that industrial-scale wind and solar projects that stripped bare the earth could cause dust storms. East County Magazine photographer Jim Pelley shot dramatic images that you can view on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org. He reported early Friday, "The wind turbines are all pretty much stopped this morning. No wind. Looks like the wind turbines will need some new filters now." Winds of 50 miles an hour were forecast, and the National Weather Service did issue a blowing dust warning shortly before the storm struck. The dust poses potential health hazards to area residents as well as hassles to clean up the mess. Desert soil harbors spores that cause valley fever, a potentially deadly disease that has reached epidemic levels in portions of the Southwest. Is it a coincidence that this is occurring in areas that also have large wind and solar farms? During the dust bowls in the 1930s, respiratory health problems rose sharply, claiming lives, including many children. A recent PBS television documentary recounted the dust bowl nightmares in detail. My own mother remembers the terror sparked by dust bowl storms during her childhood in a Texas prairie town, when children were warned to huddle under blankets as the choking dust enveloped their homes, seeping into bedrooms, filling their lungs, covering everything in sight without warning. With multiple industrial-scale wind and solar projects proposed to scrape bare agricultural lands in San Diego's East County, the potential to create dust storms is an issue that our supervisors and county planners have failed to address to date, blowing off concerns raised by residents who did mention this issue. For Pattern Energy, the dust storm is the latest in a string of serious problems at its Ocotillo Express wind facility in Imperial Valley since it opened in December 2012. The wind project was offline for several weeks this spring after a massive blade fell off a turbine, prompting a worldwide shutdown of similar turbine models. The Native American Heritage Commission for California recently ruled that the federal government erred in approving the project atop sacred burial grounds for Native Americans. 5 lawsuits remain in court on issues ranging from environmental damage to tribal concerns. And earlier this month, the Eagle expert, who was hired by Pattern for the project, was convicted of illegal actions and operating without a state or federal license, raising new potential challenges. The site has also been hit with flash floods, sits atop one of the most active earthquake faults in California, with questions about its seismic report, or lack of it, and now faces cleanup costs from the dust storm. Meanwhile, calls are mounting from the community to decommission this ill-fated project. The timing for Pattern couldn't be worse, since the company recently announced its intent to go public with an initial public offering. For East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guide, host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won 7 Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for exposing fraud and corruption. Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso.
John Mattis here. I've got some really shady deals to talk about. And the word mortgage modification comes to mind when you talk about shady deals, because mortgage modifications around the country have been ripe for ripoff artists, con men. All the industry is full of those kind of people. And if you're a homeowner and you're underwater, do not, whatever you do, do not go to a commercial mortgage modification broker, whatever they want to call themselves. They're charlatans, they're snake oil salesmen, they will take your money. Now, having said that, I'm going to tell you about the poster child for mortgage modification fraud. His name's Sam Suleman. Now, maybe you remember his name. Back in 2006, I investigated him for mortgage fraud. Back in 2006, he took control of a number of properties here in San Diego, $30 million of properties that were put in bogus names. He took the rents out of the properties, let those properties go into foreclosure. Well, he never was prosecuted for that. All he was prosecuted for was in September of 2006, when I had exposed him in a number of exposés on television. He attacked me in broad daylight and tried to kill me. It was televised around the world, and he became infamous and famous, for that matter, and ultimately went to jail for beating me up and attempting to kill me. But what's so interesting is he never went to jail for the mortgage fraud. Those homes all went into foreclosure, and we, the taxpayer, of course, had to pay for every single one of them. Now, fast forward. People like Mr. Suleman left jail. Well, when they left jail, what are they going to do with their lives? They're going to turn to mortgage modification fraud. Mortgage modification fraud is a wonderful thing. You get people underwater, you take their last little bit of money, and you tell them not to pay the bank. In other words, you make them lose their home for you to steal $3,000 from them. Mr. Suleman was doing that along with many other people. He did that across Southern California when he came out of jail. And lo and behold, finally, and I say finally, he was prosecuted for that and went back to jail. Now, none of the victims got their money back. Many of them lost their homes. But now let's fast forward to the present. When he's come out of jail again, what do you think he's doing? Well, of course, he's doing the same thing. Now we hear that he has a group called the Simplify Law Group, and he's been accused of taking money from homeowners all over the East Coast, promising them mortgage modifications, and of course, not delivering. So that leaves homeowners losing their homes, losing $3,000 to Mr. Suleman, and he's going along his merry way, enjoying his life, pocketing money. Now, the moral of the story is crime pays. White-collar crime really pays. Now, whether you're at Wall Street or you're working Southern California mortgage modification scheme, we have not seen aggressive prosecution of white-collar crime here in America because our Prosecutors are underfunded and understaffed. So my recommendation to homeowners, to people looking to take advantage of things they see offered to them, if it looks good, if it smells good, it's probably too good to be true. And I caution homeowners, I caution consumers, watch out. The scammers, schemers are out there. You got to be careful.
This is Janice Mork, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. This is Janice Mork. I'm here with Brian Kastner, who is the author of The Long Walk. He is also a military vet, and he has a mild traumatic brain injury, and he recently gave a speech at Grossmont College to faculty and staff about how to reach out to veterans. Can you tell me about your military experiences?
Sure. I was in the Air Force as an officer, but I was an explosive ordnance disposal officer. That's EOD. We're the military's bomb squad. So my experience in the military was, you know, working with different services. And so when I was in Iraq, I was actually assigned to the Army. I did a couple tours in Iraq, tours in Balad and Kirkuk, and do the things that you would expect the bomb squad to do. We took apart roadside bombs. We investigated bombings after they had happened, and we tried to search for the people who were making the devices.
Wow, very interesting. And what inspired you to write your book?
I had a lot of challenges coming home. I got out of the military in 2007, and I thought I was fine. A couple years later, it all really hit me, and I felt like I was going crazy, and I didn't have a word to explain or diagnosis or anything to explain what was happening to me. So, I mean, writers explain things. The book was explaining to myself and to my children why I was the way I was, and, you know, the book kind of took off. I thought I was writing a very small story of just what was happening to me, but you know, a lot of people have told me that they can see some of themselves in it, too.
And how old were you when you started in the military?
Well, I went in right after high school. I did Air Force ROTC in college. And so I was commissioned a second lieutenant when I was 22.
Wow, very cool. And what advice would you give to families who have been going through the same thing that you have been going through?
I think it's challenging sometimes to bridge the gulf between the family that genuinely cares and then the veteran that doesn't know how to reach out. Maybe they have an experience they don't want to talk about. Maybe they've just been doing something completely different than normal American life while they were in Iraq or Afghanistan. And so each family doesn't need to solve the whole veterans crisis or trying to solve all of society's issues with veterans. Just reach out to the one that you're closest with. You know, be ready with that understanding and try to meet halfway.
What more needs to be done for returning veterans?
I think that's tough because the easy answer is that there's always more that can be done. But there is this gap between what the Veterans Administration can provide, and there is a terrible backlog there, but then also to what the veteran actually needs. And so there's always going to be community groups, and not just the VFW or the American Legion, but groups that provide wheelchair ramps and groups that provide scholarships to the children of veterans, and finding these local charities that are each in their own way trying to fill that gap between, you know, what the actual need is of the veteran and then what the government can provide.
Okay. And when you wrote your book, did this change your perception about war?
Writing the book and explaining it maybe did a little, but more so it was going through the war. I think I was idealistic before the war, like a lot of guys are, and it's hard to have that kind of experience to see what people are able to do to each other and not come unchanged from it.
How did you get your information about the book? Did you do more research?
It's really a small book, and it's really just about my experiences. And so very little research was needed. It was things that either I had known or I had did. I wasn't trying to explain the whole Iraq war. I was just trying to explain what had happened to me.
And I just talked with Brian Kastner, author of The Long Walk. He has served in the Air Force from 1999 to 2007. He has a wife and four sons, and The Long Walk is his first book available online and in bookstores.
Now it's time for the East County Magazine Trivia Quiz.
Well, happy Friday, folks. Our contestants today are Gloria and Tom. Welcome.
Oh, good to be here. I'm looking forward to winning all the money associated with this program.
Which is none so far.
Oh,
but
darn
it. If someone
it.
Out there wants to sponsor it and offer prizes, that would be really cool.
I've been hornswoggled, or whatever the word is.
And welcome, Tom, to you as well.
Thank you.
Okay, our first question is, what did volunteers recently count 332 of in the Anza Borrego Desert?
Stones.
Coyotes.
No, no, you guys.
332.
Let me give you.
332.
Okay, I was off a little bit on the stones. I think it's over 332. Let's see. What were the choices, Alex?
The choices are wildflower species, dune buggies, horned lizards, or bighorn sheep.
All of the above.
No.
That sounds like the desert to me.
What's your guess?
All of the above.
Well, actually, the correct answer is bighorn sheep. They do an annual count where a bunch of crazy volunteers go out in 110-degree weather and count sheep. In East County, counting sheep is not what you do when you fall asleep.
I knew that. I just wanted to make other people look smart.
I forgot to put my answers in. Okay. What does a bill in Congress sponsored by an East County activist seek to outlaw individuals from owning?
Chickens.
Nope, not chickens. Any more guesses, Gloria?
I would say fireworks.
Nope, those are already illegal here. No, actually, the guesses are rocket launchers, fireworks that you already guessed, tigers and other exotic animals, or marijuana.
Tigers.
You got it. Tigers is the correct answer.
And exotic animals like Tom and Gloria here.
Something like that. Okay, next question. Primitivo and Anglianico were among the East County entries to win medals at the county fair. What are Primitivo and Anglianico?
Llamas?
Nope, they're not llamas.
They're a hybrid between rabbits and chickens?
There's no such thing, no. All right, let me give you some choices here. Horses, alpacas, wines, or paintings?
Alpacas.
Wines.
Wines is the correct answer. Good for you. Okay, we're warming up here. All right, East County Magazine's photographer Jim Pelly recently took some action photos when he was caught in the middle of something dramatic out in Ocotillo. And it wasn't the wind farm this time, folks. What was it?
A dirt bike race.
Nope, he is a dirt bike racer, but that was not the right answer.
A flash flood.
That's right. He was in the middle of a flash flood. And you can see that video on East County Magazine. Okay, we've got two more questions today. A state appellate court recently upheld San Diego County's new ordinance. What does it regulate?
Boutique wineries.
Very good.
You
I knew that
got
as
it.
Well.
Isn't timing everything? Uh-huh. Tom, timing is everything. You have to hit the buzzer, right? Right.
Seems like I could get all the answers.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, next question. Cedar Fire survivor Rudy Reyes from Lakeside, who was badly burned in the 2003 Cedar Fire, recently appeared on which reality TV show?
Survivor.
Dancing with the Stars.
No, good guesses. Actually,
Good Morning America.
No. Well, some of those were my fake-out answers, but the ones that are left are America's Got Talent or MasterChef.
MasterChef.
MasterChef it is.
How much did I win with that question?
Cooking up Indian fry bread.
I'll take the fry bread.
Now, the fry bread it is. We'll send you
That's
over to
prize.
Rudy. And that concludes another edition of the East County Trivia Quiz.
Hey, go Gloria. Yeah. Go Gloria.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Shady lane with your baby mine. You'll hold her hand. she holds yours, and that's a very good sign. That she don't hope she won't see in the good old summertime.
This is a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. As temperatures climb, it's important to stay cool. Seniors and those without air conditioning are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness. The county has provided a list of cool zones where you can beat the heat, including places in East County, such as libraries and senior centers. All are free and open to the public during designated hours. You can find a list of school zones in your area at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. The Gaskill Brothers Gunfighters will be reenacting the historical Campo gunfight at the Golden Acorn on Saturday, August 24th, as part of the Golden Acorn's Barbecue and Chili Cook-Off. The cook-off is a free event and runs from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. The reenactment of the gunfight will begin at 1 p.m. The original gunfight in the tiny town of Campo, which took place December 4, 1875, was forgotten by history for almost a century. However, the Campo gunfight lasted longer and had more casualties than the shootout at the OK Corral. The skit's director and producer, Brian Harrington, will narrate the show. Brian has authored the novel Campo, The Forgotten Gunfight, and will be signing copies of his book after the show. The Golden Acorn is located off I-8 in Campo. A food tasting walking tour of downtown Julian as part of Bite San Diego stops at Julian Cider Mill, Julian Candy Basket, Apple Alley Bakery, Candied Apple Pastry, Bailey Barbecue, Julian Hard Cider, and Mom's Pie. This yummy tour requires tickets, has a minimum age of 18 years old, and is led each Saturday and Sunday through mid-November from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. See BiteSanDiego.com for details and ticket purchase. Visit the Bonita Museum and Cultural Center to meet the artists and view new work from West Coast drawings artists for their 10th anniversary exhibition entitled Drawing Alive. The exhibit will also include live demonstrations with Joan Thompson on August 24th and begins at 1 p.m. The exhibit is also open next Saturday, August 31st. The San Diego-based Gypsy Swing Cats perform a blend of swing, jazz, and blues. Their music merges gypsy melodies and rhythms with the influences of American jazz, reminiscent of Paris in the 1930s. Cool, charming, and classy. The Gypsy Swing Cats will be performing on Wednesday evenings from 6:30 to 9 p.m., ongoing through mid-December at Kaffeemeister in Santee. A Rancho San Diego food truck gathering each Thursday from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. is an ongoing event to support the Valhalla High School Athletics Department. Valhalla High School is located in the Rancho San Diego area of El Cajon. Enjoy the Sam Johnson Jazz Group, featuring Johnson on electric and upright bass, Alan Worthington on guitar, and George Casas on sax. The jazz group performs on Fridays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., at Cosmos Coffee Cafe in La Mesa. The musical Annie, presented by the Visionary School for the Performing Arts, will be performed at the Visionary Performance Space on El Cajon Boulevard in San Diego near La Mesa. Performances of this popular play are on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings at 7 p.m., with one matinee performance at 2 p.m. on Saturday. There's still time to catch the last of the summer concerts in East County. First, on Thursday night, August 22nd, from 6:30 p.m. to 8 p.m., Santee Summer Concert Series presents the Cadillacs as they perform rock and roll hits from the 50s through the 90s. This concert also features a classic car display by the East County Cruisers. Next, Dinner and a Concert, formerly Concerts on the Promenade, is a weekly concert and dance hosted by Downtown El Cajon Business Partners, performed on the Prescott Promenade, which is surrounded by a variety of restaurants. This Friday, August 23rd, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., enjoy a live performance by Back to the Garden, a group devoted to Woodstock tributes. Prescott Promenade is located on East Main Street in downtown El Cajon. On Saturday, August 24th, there will be a Celebration of Life benefit concert at the VFW post on Tavern Road in Alpine. The concert will honor our nation's military and their families. It will include performances by Three Chord Justice, The Legends, and special guest Tegan Taylor. Everyone is welcome to dance and enjoy food and beverages. At Sweetwater Summit Regional Park and Campground in Bonita, there will be ranger-led hikes at Red Hill on Saturdays and Sundays from 10 a.m. to noon, featuring 1.5 miles of walking and taking in the sights, including native birds and plants, and points of interest. Bring water, a hat, a walking stick, and binoculars. Groups and clubs welcome. Meet at the flagpole next to the ranger station. Summer Movies in the Park program of San Diego County Parks has 2 movies this weekend in East County. Hotel Transylvania will be shown on Friday, August 23rd at Lemon Grove Park. And on Saturday, August 24th, The Croods is featured at Jess Martin Park in Julian. All movies start at dusk. Also at San Diego County Parks this weekend, join the ranger at Otay Lakes County Park on Sunday, August 25th. For a fun Kumeyaay supermarket scavenger hunt designed for kids ages 8 through 12. The hunt runs every Sunday through September 29th at 12:30 p.m. Scavenger hunters will learn how the native peoples of San Diego survived without grocery stores as they look for the plants the Kumeyaay used for everyday needs and make connections between modern conveniences and ancient ways. This environmental education class is 1 hour long and leaves from the ranger office. A minimum of 5 participants is needed for the hike to take place. For further information on this and other county parks, see the website for Parks and Recreation, San Diego County. The Braxham Brass Quintet will be performing in concert at the Lakeside Community Presbyterian Church in Lakeside on Sunday, August 25th at 4 p.m. Braxham Brass specializes in bringing new and exciting brass music to audiences. Next week, we will be featuring an upcoming powwow, Barona's 43rd annual powwow at the Barona Indian Reservation in Lakeside, will be taking place all weekend from August 30th to September 1st. There is free admission and camping, as well as Native American vendors, contest dancing in all categories, including gourd dancing, hand drum contest, and men's fancy dance will be presented. All of this information is on our comprehensive calendar online at www.eastcountymagazine.org for festivals, cultural events, family activities, outdoor adventures, street fairs, wine tastings, theater, food events, and more. If you have an East County event to add to our calendar, please email it to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. See you around East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ and East County Magazine. Today, my newsmaker is George Gastel. George is a member of the Lemon Grove City Council for the last 4 years. He has previously served on the Lemon Grove School Board. He's a history professor at Grossmont and Miramar Community Colleges and previously at San Diego State, and he comes from a long line of politicians and educators. Both his mother and his father ran for Congress. His mother served on the school board, Janet Gastel. His father, Gordon Gastel, was a geologist and a professor at San Diego State, and unfortunately he passed away last year, but George has followed in his footsteps, and he's here today to share with us some of his wisdom through the years and some information about some exciting new things happening in Lemon Grove, an exciting 50th birthday celebration he has coming up, as well as bring us some international perspective back from his recent trip to the Middle East. George, welcome to the show.
Well, it's an honor to be here. I should note, I grew up in La Mesa, and my mother was on the La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, and my family moved to Lemon Grove in 1994.
So you've been out there for almost 20 years. How mm-hmm. has the community changed since you first set eyes on Lemon Grove, George?
It's been changing gradually. It's more and more multicultural. And it also seems to be getting younger. We have quite a lot of young people, and we have quite a few senior citizens, too. What the biggest change that's really affected our community life is that we don't have the same kind of old guard of folks who've lived in Lemon Grove for a long time, who volunteer for lots of different organizations. We don't have as many of those folks as we did 20 years ago. This has been a huge challenge for getting community activities going. But we have a new batch of folks that are coming forward, and really it's a transition that we're going through with getting new types of folks plugged in.
Right. Now, a lot of these folks are coming from all around the world. I believe I've heard that Lemon Grove is the most ethnically diverse city in California. Is that true?
Well, I don't know about the whole state of California, but it certainly is very ethnically diverse. Yeah. When I was on the school board, we noticed that the largest population among the children was Latino, and African Americans were the second largest group, followed closely by Caucasians. But that only tells you part of the story, that we actually have several Asian groups and several Middle Eastern cultures and immigrants from Africa as well.
Right. They're coming from Ethiopia and Somalia and all kinds of places, the Sudan, all sorts of different nations. Lemon Grove has some very exciting things going on, I understand. Tell us a little bit about some of the downtown redevelopment and new projects coming in.
Well, at one point there were about 8 major buildings going on in Lemon Grove. They weren't all related to the city, but it is very exciting just to see the growth. The one that's probably the biggest and most noticeable right now is the housing project, Citronica 1, and Citronica 2 will be coming later, but Citronica 1 is creating quite a lot of affordable housing, and it's practically right next to the Lemon Grove trolley station. That's actually where I'm having my birthday roast.
Fun. We're going to get to that in just a minute.
And the other giant building that's new is the library, which is a project of the school district and
beautiful
the
building.
County library system.
Now, there's also a promenade being built.
Yeah.
That's a public space near the old trolley station. Tell us what that's going to include.
It's going to have benches. It's going to have public art, lemon slices.
Lemon slices.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to have 3 different windmills representing the past, the present, and the future.
Interesting. Now, I believe you told me the last public art was the giant lemon, the landmark lemon. Now there's going to be lemon slices there moving forward. Are they going to have areas here on the promenade for things like farmers markets and other kinds of public activities to benefit the community?
We're expecting that there will be carts or possibly stands, and we actually have been working on an ordinance to regulate and actually encourage that kind of commercial activity to give the more vitality to the area.
Very interesting. So if you haven't seen Lemon Grove in a long time, you really should go visit. There's some
yeah,
interesting changes.
If you haven't been to Lemon Grove in the past year, you really haven't been to Lemon Grove.
Now, they've also got some marvelous murals and things that have gone in there showing the history of it.
Right, yeah. Well, one of my friends from the school board, Jan Laval, was involved with that project, painting the side of the bakery.
Yeah, that's the Historical Society was involved in that, and it shows 4 or 5 different large murals, each depicting in great detail a different period in Lemon Grove's colorful history.
I like that they have a big picture there. They have the native peoples and the missionaries, and they give quite a perspective. There have been human beings in Lemon Grove for probably about 10,000 years.
Right, and then later the Spanish. Lemon Grove has been through some tough budget times, too. Last year, they were forced to cut the rec department and move some of those programs into other departments and things, which I know George actually had voted against. Mm-hmm. What's going on now with the city's budget, George? Are things looking any better?
Yeah, it's rebuilding. During the budget crisis, we lost almost a third of our city employees outside of the fire and police. We're not bringing back the programs right away, but what we're doing is we're rebuilding our reserve, and you know, we're planning to gradually bring back some of the things very carefully. We don't know what the future is, and you know, if you look at the history of the state, it tends to be very cyclical in terms of the budget. So we want to make sure that we not only come back from the latest budget crisis, but we have to prepare for the next budget crisis as well.
Right. And Lemon Grove, it should be noted, is a city that does not have the luxury, like some of its neighboring cities, of a very large tax base. They don't have big shopping centers and lots of car dealers to bring in that.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that we get done so much. If you look at how much we collect per resident in the city, we get an awful lot done.
Right. And I imagine those redevelopment projects came with some state redevelopment money. Is that correct, George?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother issue, is getting the state to come through on money that was committed and that has already been spent.
What exciting events are coming up in Lemon Grove?
Well, we're going to have a grand opening for Citronica One coming up real soon. And we had the grand opening for the library.
Imagine the annual holiday bonfire, as usual, which is a great community event.
Yeah, the bonfire is getting bigger and bigger, and we need to think about making it over a longer time span, possibly to accommodate the crowds. It's amazing how popular it is. It's shortly before Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, this is huge. You have your own very special event coming up. Some people have the traditional birthday party for the 50th, or they go take a trip, and you decided to allow your fellow friends and community members to hold a roast and toast of George Gasol. How did you ever get talked into this, George?
Well, you know, I actually thought that since I'm turning 50, I thought it would be good to do something meaningful instead of just having a party. There is a party aspect to it, but I also wanted to do something meaningful and reflect a little bit. And my friend Raquel, we'll see if she's still my friend when this
Raquel
is over.
Raquel Velasquez, the newly elected member of the city council.
Vasquez, yeah. Raquel said that, well, how about a roast and toast? And I think it'll turn out well. We'll see. I just hope people aren't too mean. But yeah, we were thinking that since there are so many people that I've worked with over the years, that it'd be good just to get an idea of what have we been doing together, you know, and what have we accomplished. And I'm sure there'll be some funny stories. I've actually been warned about a couple things. But
I remember you wearing out your walking shoes, walking those precincts. Hopefully maybe someone will give you a few new pairs of running shoes.
Yeah, well, some people know the truth is that first time I got elected to the school board, it was my parents that walked most of Lemon Grove. They told me that I was too busy.
They taught you how. Huh?
Yeah, I learned quite a bit from them. There's quite a lot that we've accomplished together, particularly in Lemon Grove, but in East County as well. I mean, obviously, it's my 50th birthday and a chance for me to reflect, but I see it as not just me, but but what many of us have done together. The school district changed dramatically during the 10 years I was on the school board, and I was very pleased with the direction that we were going in, embracing diversity and increasing parent and grandparent involvement, and building a library together with the library system. And some of the best things happened after I left. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it helps to have that long-term perspective that it's not what you do this week or next week. What you do this week and next week could have impact a year or two later. So it's good to have a long-term perspective and reflect on what's been happening.
Absolutely. Now, is the roast open to the public, or is this for friends?
Well, yeah, anybody can go.
Where and when will it be, and how do they get more information?
It's at the community room at Citronica One, which is 7775 North Avenue in Lemon Grove.
And it's Friday the 23rd, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
6 to 9?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. If they want to let me know they're coming, they can find me on Facebook.
Yeah, I think the whole world's on Facebook now, just about. Speaking of the long-term perspective, as a historian and someone who's visited Israel before, it must have been fascinating for you, George, to go back for a recent trip. When were you there first and how things changed?
Well, I was there in 1982 when I was a college student.
Wow. So almost over 30 years ago.
Yeah, the Israelis were occupying part of Lebanon at the time. Yeah, that was a fairly tense time. Well, most times are tense. But 31 years ago, as a college student, I was there for 4 months in a program where we studied the conflict between the Israelis and the Arabs, and visited quite a few places all over Israel and the occupied territories. And just recently, I was there for 8 days for a program that was sponsored by the Jewish community.
And it should be noted that you're neither Jewish nor Arab or Muslim.
Right.
That you're actually Quaker?
Yeah, I belong to the Religious Society of Friends.
So peace-oriented, peaceful religion.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely coming from the perspective of wanting to see a settlement there that would have a huge impact on all of us. I think that it's extremely complicated and has a long history, but the most important thing to realize is that most people on both sides of the conflict really want a solution.
That's good to hear. Now, you visited both Jerusalem and the West Bank, I understand. What were conditions like?
The West Bank is still a fairly tense place. And it's exciting, though, to see that Ramallah has grown dramatically. It's about the size of El Cajon, and it's much bigger than it was 31 years ago, and there's a lot more economic activity, so that's very exciting. We could tell that the checkpoints and the walls and that sort of thing are causing quite a lot of stress. And the settlements, what people call settlements, are actually small cities that the Israelis are building on the West Bank. I believe that they are an impediment to the peace process. I've always felt that the Israeli settlements on the West Bank are an impediment to the peace process, but I did appreciate the fact that the chance to actually visit a settlement, and when we say settlements, they're really small cities is what they are, where the Israelis go and build on the Israeli-occupied territory in the West Bank. And I had mixed feelings about visiting a settlement, but the one we visited was one where they're building a little city. I think they're planning to have it be about 30,000 people, not far from East Jerusalem. And they actually told us that they had very good relations with the Arabs around them and were cooperating quite a bit. What I found most interesting was that the Israeli settlers and the Arabs in the local area joined together to say that they didn't want this wall that is being built. Yeah, and they managed to get, in their particular part of the West Bank, they managed to get the wall to not be built.
Right, and of course, the reason for the wall ostensibly has been the repeated attacks that are...
Yeah, the wall is different depending on who you talk to.
Right.
A lot of the Palestinians that live on the West Bank see the wall as very oppressive, but the Israelis feel that the wall is making them safer. And it's one of those things where people just see something completely differently, depending on their point of view. The one positive thing I can say about the wall is that it has probably deterred some people from coming to Israel to blow things up.
Right, and with Hamas still in charge in Palestine.
Well, Hamas got voted in Gaza. And we didn't go to Gaza because it was thought to be too dangerous.
Right. If you could be the president for a day or the secretary of state, George, what things would you do in this region to help bring peace to the area that perhaps have not been done, or has everything that can be tried been done?
Well, an awful lot has been tried. I think that the international community does have a huge role, the United States and the European Union, and the Arab countries that are reasonably stable can have a big role in the Middle East.
So you think some other nations perhaps have not done as much as they could or should do, George? Can you give us some specific examples there?
Yeah, that particular part of the Middle East has been off the radar screen for quite a while. Quite a lot was accomplished during the Clinton era. The Oslo Accords made people very, very encouraged. That was back in the 90s. People were very encouraged and believed that peace could be coming, and there was actually a lot of talk about an economic boom coming out of that part of the region. And it didn't quite materialize like we were hoping, but there was significant progress that people might not completely appreciate. The Palestinians have had a chance to organize themselves under the Palestinian Authority, and it's been very, very rocky, and in some cases negative in the sense of money being wasted, and probably a lot of people would say the wrong people getting elected. But new entities go through a rocky period, and I think that Palestinians are probably not unusual in that regard. I think that you really have to take the long run and take the attitude that you're in it for the long haul. There are going to be ups and downs and difficulties. And the Israelis, your average Israeli actually understands this better than you'd expect, because their country, of course, has been around since 48, and actually many of them have been there even longer. But it's going to take a long time for things to sort themselves out, and part of the problem that they're running into is a sense, on both sides, they don't really have forever to work this out, that they have to go back to the table and try again to get a settlement. Neither one of the sides we talked to was very optimistic, but they want to go to the table and give it their best try because they think that's absolutely essential. There are a couple things that are encouraging. One is that when we talked to, we actually visited the PLO office in Ramallah.
Oh my goodness, wow.
Yeah, yeah, that would not have happened 31 years ago. There was no PLO office in the occupied territories.
Did you also talk to Israeli officials while you were there?
Yes, we talked to one of Netanyahu's deputies who's working on the peace process.
Interesting. So when we say this guy is connected, he really
and
is.
So the PLO position has evolved quite a lot over the years. They're looking for a solution to the refugee crisis that could include resettlement and repatriation. And I was thinking that they're opening the door to the international community.
Well, that's encouraging, then.
Yeah, to find a practical solution to the question of what do you do with the Palestinian refugees.
Right, when you have two groups of people who both think historically they have a right to occupy the same land, it's an inherent conflict, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. And one of the things I found frustrating about the conflict is that the refugees tend to be forgotten or manipulated.
Now, how many refugees are there?
Oh, there's millions.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And they're in several different countries. They're actually the majority of the population in Jordan. The international community could play a huge role in resettling or repatriating refugees.
Are you saying the Arab nations in particular?
Definitely. Most of them live in Arab nations. It's hard to say exactly what's holding this back. But I think that a lot of people have been trying to keep this refugee situation alive for their own political motives. But the PLO is sending out a signal that they really want to move on this. They want a solution.
Very interesting. Well, there's certainly precedent for that. I mean, you look at Egypt, Anwar Sadat, who at one time was considered by some a terrorist himself, and he came to the table eventually in the peace process with Jimmy Carter, right?
Right. Another thing that's encouraging is that on both sides, there's a recognition that you can't go back to 67 or any other year, that you have to work with a lot of what's happened since. The Israelis have been putting out the message that they're willing to give up quite a bit. But the number one thing that the Israelis are looking for is security.
The right for their nation to exist and for people to be in peace, basically.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the PLO has already come out and said that Israel has a right to exist. That's a tricky one where the two sides have a different idea of what Israel and Palestine should be and could be, and a different idea of the two-state solution. But the PLO has come out and said that Israel is okay with them. What they want is they want their own state that can exist side by side and be viable.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that they've had in the recent past with the Israeli proposals is that it's too restrictive on their movement, and the most recent really concrete proposal coming from the Israeli would have had the Israelis practically surrounding the Palestinians and also would have them divided in three different pieces.
Mm.
There is a solution somewhere, and it's elusive to both sides, but I think people have a feeling that there is a solution.
I think someday when you're around celebrating your 100th birthday, maybe, might be peace in the region.
Yeah, well, I think that it'll go one of two ways. One way is that it could go for the two-state solution, which is what people tend to be talking about. And the key to that is that you have to find a way for the Israelis to have the security that they're looking for and the Palestinians to have the autonomy that they're looking for. And they have to be able to circulate in their state, and they also have to be able to circulate with their Arab neighbors and have access to the sea. And
opportunities, I would imagine, economic prosperity, opportunities that they really
The viability of the Palestinian state is a huge issue because, you know, we know it's going to be a small country, and it's going to have a lot of challenges. To be viable, it needs to have access to water, and it also will need to have a trade relationship with Israel. Here's one of the great ironies of the whole discussion, is that the Palestinians are put in their negotiating plan for what they say they want. They want to be trading with Israel.
Interesting.
Yeah, and what they're putting out there is that if the peace agreement comes through the way they're talking, it would mean the end of the Arab boycott of Israel.
Fascinating.
Yeah, because the Palestinians are actually insisting on trade with Israel.
Fascinating. Well, it's from a social justice standpoint. We are the Network for Social Justice. Yeah, it's fascinating because there's two groups here that both really have denied their social justice from their point of view.
Their Palestinian state couldn't be functional without without trade with Israel. And of course, they also are insisting that they be able to trade with their Arab neighbors. And you put that together, if they're trading with their Arab neighbors and they're trading with Israel, then effectively the Arab boycott of Israel would be over.
Interesting. Well, it's fascinating to think of the possibilities there.
See, this is where people often make a mistake, is they think about all the things that could go wrong, okay? And, you know, you follow the Middle East and you find that whenever you do something that you think is positive, there's
there's extremists that tend to try to derail the peace process, actually.
Yeah, but here's some of the things that could go right. An end to the Arab boycott of Israel would be huge economically for both Israel and for the Arab countries. Would be a big economic help. Another thing, when we talked to the mayor of Tel Aviv, was very passionate about wanting some kind of solution. He said that if they could come up with a peace proposal that actually lasted, he predicted that tourism to Tel Aviv would increase fivefold.
Wow, that's huge.
The mayor of Tel Aviv told us that in recent years, they think the Israel brand isn't very good, so they've been pushing the Tel Aviv brand. But he says with a peace settlement, he thinks tourism to Tel Aviv would increase fivefold. So there's worry and pessimism. There's also a lot of thinking that they have to give it their best try and give it their best shot, and if they can succeed, there'll be huge benefits.
George, thank you very much. It's inspiring to know that there is hope for the region out there yet. And we certainly appreciate you coming in today to share your views and your insights on not only the Middle East, but right here at home, what's going on in Lemon Grove. And on behalf of KNSJ, we all wish you a very happy 50th birthday.
Oh, wonderful. I love KNSJ, and I'm so excited about the development of the station. And I also want to say that Miriam Raftery is quite well known in the East County. It's an honor to be interviewed by East County's premier journalist. I should also say that I feel very fortunate to have friends like Raquel Vasquez, who are putting together this roast and toast. And I hope I still feel that they're my friends when the activity is done.
I hope so, too. We're looking forward to being at the roast and hopefully getting a few sound bites to come back and play for our listeners next week. Thank you, George.
Okay.
Very, very much.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.